you to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. Today, I'm happy to present my late Christmas show about Jesus, and I'm very happy to interview Dr. Marvin Meyer. Dr. Meyer is the author of numerous books and articles on Greco-Roman and Christian religions in antiquity and late antiquity, and on Albert Schweitzer's Ethics of Reverence for Life. Among his most recent books are the Gnostic Gospels of Jesus, the Gospel of Mary, Secret Gospels, Essays on Thomas, and the Secret Gospel of Mark, The Ancient Mysteries, a Sourcebook of Sacred Text, The Unknown Sayings of Jesus, The Magical Book of Mary and the Angels, Text, Translations, and Commentaries, and The Gospel of Thomas, The Hidden Sayings of Jesus, and he has also edited or co-edited The Gnostic Bible, Reverence for Life, Albert Schweitzer for the 21st Century, Magic and Rituals in the Ancient World, Jesus Then and Now, Images of Jesus in History and Christology, From Quest to Q, and Ancient Christic Magic, Coptic Texts of Ritual Power. His books and articles have been translated into Spanish, Portuguese, French, and Japanese, and the Gospel of Thomas, of which his is the standard text, has been listed as one of the 100 best spiritual books of the 20th century. He has been interviewed on television programs that have aired on ABC, BBC, CNN, A&E, The History Channel, and Odyssey, and on radio programs that include BBC, Radio National, National Public Radio, and The Voice of America. Currently, he is Grissett Professor of Bible and Christian Studies and co-chair of the Department of Religious Studies, Chapman University. He is also director of the Chapman University Albert Schweitzer Institute. More information on his extensive activities can be found on my website, www.holistichealthshow.com, or at www.chapman.edu/Meyer. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Marvin, and I look forward to learning more about Jesus and those around him when he lived.
Well, thank you. It's a joy to be chatting with you about this.
Thank you. First, please tell us what is meant by the term Gnostic and about the discovery of these remarkable Gospels.
Right. The word Gnostic comes from the Greek, gnosis, and the Greek word gnosis means knowledge. But the kind of knowledge that gnosis refers to typically is not ordinary knowledge, but rather it is it's special knowledge. Mm-hmm. It is insight. It is a knowledge of oneself and perhaps the transcendent side of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So that for a movement, for a philosophical or religious movement to be a movement of gnosis is to be tied to a concern for mystical knowledge and insight and the real meaning of life in the world and one's place in the world. Much to our pleasure, we have had over the past decades a number of discoveries of texts in the sands of Egypt. The sands of Egypt are very dry and are very forgiving when it comes to preserving papyrus and parchment manuscripts. And mm-hmm. so we have had a wealth of discoveries that have come out of Egypt, including Gnostic texts, Gospels, and other kinds of texts that really have shed a great deal of new light on exactly who these mystics were. Because it turns out they were very important mm-hmm. in the early church and in Judaism and later on even in the world of Islam. Mm-hmm. They played a large role and were significant, but we knew very little about them before these discoveries. We knew about them essentially from their opponents. And as you might imagine, in this kind of polemical literature, the opponents of the Gnostics don't have very many good things to say about them. And so now to be able to read texts like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Judas from these new discoveries really has has changed the face of early Christianity and Judaism of the day and has given us a new kind of way of evaluating what was going on. It's a very exciting time to be involved in this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Then, Marvin, can you tell us a little bit or like an overview of some of the new things that you learned from your research that are different from that is written in the Bible?
Well, absolutely. In fact, I probably should also say that that there have been a number of different discoveries from the very last years of the 19th century to almost the present day. And just to give you some sense of what those discoveries have been, there was a discovery of a bunch of papyrus fragments in an old garbage heap in Egypt at Oxyrhynchus. We call these the Oxyrhynchus papyri. And from these fragments, we have gotten all kinds of insights, including insights into what we now know to be some fragments from Greek editions of the Gospel of Thomas, a gospel we knew about by title but knew very little about before. And about the same time, there was another discovery made of what is called the Berlin Gnostic Codex, and that includes a number of texts, the secret book of John and the Gospel of Mary and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That occurred at about the same time. Then the Nag Hammadi Library was discovered in the 1940s and still is being discussed a great deal. That includes the Gospel of Thomas, the entirety of the Gospel of Thomas, now in Coptic or Egyptian translation. And a bit more recently, in the 1970s, it seems, Codex Chakos was discovered, and the leading text, the most discussed text in Codex Chakos, is the Gospel of Judas, that is Judas Iscariot. So here we have all these different codices or ancient books with all kinds of new texts, new gospels and new Acts of the Apostles and new secret books and so on. And the light that this is shedding on early Christianity and Judaism, as I said, is quite remarkable and very exciting.
Great. Then, in general, what are some of the sayings that were attributed to Jesus that you discovered from all of these sources that are not in the Bible?
Well, Carl, as you might imagine, these kinds of texts, since they focus upon gnosis, are concerned mainly with what Jesus has to say. And so there are lots of sayings of Jesus. There are revelations that come from Jesus. There are discussions that Jesus has with his disciples. Sometimes Jesus picks out a certain disciple as a special disciple with whom he has a dialogue and a conversation, like Thomas or Mary Magdalene or Judas Iscariot or some person like that.
Mm-hmm.
So in these kinds of texts, there are lots of sayings and discourses of Jesus, because that's the main point of what Jesus is all about. The main point is not the cross and not the resurrection. The main point of what Jesus is his sayings, his communications, his words, and they are thought to live on beyond any kind of body or any kind of physical existence. And I suppose that of these various Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas is most well known for the sayings, the hidden sayings of Jesus that are to be found in the Gospel of Thomas. Here is a collection of sayings, some of which are similar to the New Testament, many of which are quite different. Some of them, in fact, seem to be similar to New Testament sayings, but seem to have an earlier kind of form. So the Gospel of Thomas must be, in my opinion, a rather early kind of text, and is not only significant for understanding gnosis and the development of Gnostic thought, but it may also be important for understanding something of Jesus, Jesus as a Jewish teacher of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can just mention a couple of sayings from the very beginning of the Gospel of Thomas. In fact, it sounds quite nice in Coptic, if I can just read that opening prologue from the Gospel of Thomas in Coptic or in Egyptian. Na'i na enshaje et heip, enta Jesus et onek jo, avo afsahisu enki didymus judas tohomas. These are the hidden sayings that the living Jesus spoke and Judas Thomas, the twin, recorded. This is Thomas. This is the Thomas who is well known from the New Testament Gospel of John as Doubting Thomas, because in the Gospel of John he has lots of doubts and lots of uncertainties, and he will not believe until he puts his finger into the wounds of Jesus and so on. Well, in the Gospel of Thomas, Thomas has no doubts. He is very sure. He is close to Jesus. In fact, it is said that he is the twin, and it seems that in all likelihood, the author and the readers, the early readers of this text, thought that he was not just anybody's twin, but was probably the twin brother of Jesus himself. So these are the hidden sayings. That is, they're sayings that need to be listened to carefully. One has to encounter and unpack the sayings. One has to interpret the sayings in order to find out what they mean, and they come from the living Jesus. In the Gospel of Thomas, it is thought that Jesus is a living being. Even, you know, after the crucifixion, you know, through the subsequent decades and centuries, he still is a living being. But he lives not in his body. He lives not in some other kind of way. He lives specifically in his sayings.
Mm-hmm.
His sayings not only are alive, but they continue to be alive, and they provide life. So the text goes on. And he said, whoever discovers the interpretation of these sayings will not taste death. The Gospel of Thomas, like other Gospels, is concerned with salvation. How do you find salvation or healing or wholeness in your life? But the New Testament Gospels would say, well, you find this through the cross and through the resurrection of Jesus, and Jesus died for your sins, and he rose as the first fruits of all those that can rise from the dead. That's not what the Gospel of Thomas says.
Mm-hmm.
The Gospel of Thomas says, whoever discovers the interpretation of these sayings, whoever listens to Jesus, dialogues with Jesus, understands what Jesus really means, and takes those sayings, those words to heart, will not taste death. That's how you find true life.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the next saying, the means by which you come to life, the epistemology, the search for knowledge is described. Jesus says, let one who seeks not stop seeking until one finds. That sounds kind of familiar from the New Testament, but notice how the saying goes on. When one finds, one will be troubled. When one is troubled, one will marvel and will reign over all. That's how you get to the empire of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you get to the kingdom of God, by seeking and finding and being disturbed and troubled, because what you find calls into question all of your suppositions about life in the world, but then you will find marvelous things and you will reign as a king or queen in the reign of God. Maybe I can mention one more saying, the next one, which has a bit of a Jesus joke. In this saying, Jesus is talking about the empire kingdom of God and is raising the issue that we still are raising to the present day. That is, if there is a new reign, a new kingdom, a new empire of God, where is that anyway? I mean, is it up in the sky somewhere? Is it above us? I mean, in the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, it is said that Jesus ascended to heaven and is up above. Is that where the kingdom of God is, up there? Or is it underground? Is it in Hades, as Greeks and Romans thought the realm of the dead was underground and in a realm down below? Well, Jesus is. If your leaders, that is, your religious leaders, say to you, look, the kingdom is in heaven, then the birds of heaven will precede you. They'll get there before you because they have a head start. They're flying in the right direction. If your leaders say to you, it is in the sea, that is, it's underground, it's down below the land somewhere, then the fish will precede you because they have a head start. Rather, the kingdom is inside you and it is outside you. There is something external about the kingdom, but there also is something that involves the empire, the reign, the presence of God within. It's within your heart, and it's also out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That is the marvel. That is the insight, and that is the knowledge that one comes to when one is sincere and is devoted to seeking Jesus and seeking the kingdom of God through the sayings and words of Jesus. And that's the kind of message that you get in these Gospels and these texts of Gnosis.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch to the saying that there is light within a person of light, and it shines in the whole world. If it does not shine, it is dark. Is that then what is referring to heaven or your higher self or the God within that we seek?
Right, yeah, that is saying 24 of the Gospel of Thomas, and it's like many of the sayings. There's something about the teachings of Jesus, especially in the Gospel of Thomas, that can be quite beguiling. Sometimes they're riddle-like, and when you think back even to what the New Testament has to say about the teachings of Jesus, sometimes he was rather guarded in what he had to say. Sometimes he told a story, and he then would ask the students and disciples around him, the followers around him, did you get it? I mean, do you understand what this is all about? He looked for dialogue. You know, the historical Jesus looked to dialogue with people and often raised certain questions and left some things hanging. Well, the Gospel of Thomas does the very same kind of thing. It often has sayings that need to be elucidated. One has to struggle a bit to find the meaning. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, here too, part of the purpose of a saying like saying 24 of the Gospel of Thomas is to encourage you and me and any reader to struggle with this. His followers are around him, and Jesus says, whoever has ears should hear. That is, perk up your ears, listen carefully. There is light within a person of light, and it shines on the whole world. If it does not shine, it is dark. Even the Coptic is a little uncertain here. There is light within a person of light, and it shines, that is the light, or maybe the person shines on the whole world, or maybe there really isn't so much of a difference between the light within a person and the person himself or herself that will shine. Mm-hmm. But the point of all this seems to be something along the lines of what we've been talking about, namely that a human being, a true human being, has something within himself or herself that is light. You may not know it, you may not see it, you may not recognize it. You may forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
It may be obscured by ignorance. But there is light within a person that can shine. And when you let your light shine, in fact, I remember when I was a kid in Sunday school, there was a song about that. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what the Gospel of Thomas mm-hmm. says. If you have that light within you, and if you let it shine, if you let the light of God shine, it will illumine the world. But if you don't let it shine, there's darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And darkness is ignorance
mm-hmm.
and forgetfulness. Yeah, that's how I would read this particular saying. Again, it's a hidden saying. The Gospel of Thomas says it's a hidden saying that needs to be understood. It needs to be interpreted. But it seems to have that kind of meaning, that there is an inner self, there is a higher self, there is a self that is an enlightened self. And that is the self that can shed light on people around and can make a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. Is there more about the Gospel of Thomas and the way he presented Jesus that you would like to mention?
Well, you know, Carl, there is a great deal about the Gospel of Thomas. It is a remarkable text. It's a text of great beauty. In fact, it's such a meaningful text that people are debating how to use the text.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few people around that would like to have it be canonized, that
mm-hmm.
is to say, would like it to be used as a sacred text, as an inspiring text, as a holy kind of a text, next to other Gospels like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. This one didn't make the cut, but some people think maybe it's not too late.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can still find ways to use this particular text. But I suppose that maybe I could just share a saying or two. There are some new parables, some new stories that Jesus tells that we haven't heard before in the other Gospels, but
mm-hmm.
we can read them in the Gospel of Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these are wonderful stories. And what's intriguing about these stories is that, you know, in the New Testament, quite often when Jesus tells a parable, he'll haul the disciples or the students aside, and he'll say, now listen, let me tell you what it really means. It doesn't mean what you think it means, but it really is a kind of allegory. For instance, the parable of the sower that sows seed, that's not really about a sower. It really is about sowing the word, that is, preaching the word, and who listens and who doesn't, who responds and who doesn't. That's the way parables often are structured in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us scholars do not believe that Jesus spoke in allegories.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that secondary interpretation has been added by the author, added by somebody else to help explain something. Just in case you live in Rome and you never saw a sower, you have no idea what the rural life of a sower is all about,
mm-hmm.
you can still find meaning in that because it really isn't about sowing seed. It really is about preaching in church and so forth. Well, interestingly, in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus speaks in parables, he speaks in stories, but he does not add the allegorical interpretations.
Mm.
In other words, the stories seem to be closer to Jesus in their form than some of the New Testament stories,
mm-hmm.
because they don't have that secondary addition of that kind of allegorical understanding that is imposed upon it. So we have a saying like this. It's numbered as saying 97. In the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, "The Father's kingdom or the Father's reign is like a woman who was carrying a jar full of meal. While she was walking along a distant road, the handle of the jar broke and the meal spilled behind her along the road. She did not know it. She had not noticed a problem. When she reached her home, she put down the jar and discovered that it was empty." Now, that's a perfectly good and understandable story.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly how to interpret that, what it means, is left up to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that is very similar, I think, to what the historical Jesus did when he told stories and said, now, so what do you think about God now? What do you think about the reign of God and the presence of God in the world now? Let me give you one other saying, Carl, that
mm-hmm.
I think is just rather a remarkable saying. Saying 108, because it also speaks very much to what we have been chatting about, namely, what is there in Jesus that really can change us? What does it mean to follow Jesus and to listen to what he has to say?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus says, "Whoever drinks from my mouth will become like me. I myself shall become that person, and the hidden things will be revealed to that person." What this suggests is that if you drink from the mouth of Jesus, you are drinking from his words. You're drinking his words into
mm-hmm.
yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you'll become Jesus-like. And Jesus says, "I'll become that person."
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I'll become mystically identified with that person. In fact, a text like the Gospel of Philip, another text in the Nag Hammadi
mm-hmm.
Library, says, it's not enough to become a Christian. You've got to become Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be one with Jesus. And the Gospel of Thomas says you can become one with Jesus. And then whatever is hidden, whatever is hidden by ignorance will become clear to you, and you'll become that way. You'll come to be one with Jesus, Jesus says here, by encountering his sayings, by dialoguing, by understanding what he has to say, and taking those words into your mind and living out of their power. These are some of the kinds of sayings that we have
mm-hmm.
in the Gospel of Thomas. It's truly a very moving and a very exciting text.
Right, and I like that, right. Then in the Gospel of Judas, as far as traditionally, he has been depicted as a traitor of Jesus. But in the Gospels that you have, he is seen in a different light. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the figure of Judas Iscariot is one of the most engaging and enigmatic and disturbing figures, I think, in all of Christian literature. And in fact, his role goes beyond Christian literature because he has been used as the kind of poster boy of anti-Semitism. He has a role within Islamic literature as well. And in some texts, in fact, it is even said that Prophet Isa or Jesus, as he is called in Islamic literature, was not actually crucified, but rather the Romans got the wrong guy. They crucified
mm-hmm.
Judas instead. So
mm-hmm.
the role of Judas Iscariot is huge, and the traditions about Judas are very disturbing, very interesting in so many ways. But here in the Gospel of Judas, there is a different kind of Judas.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the Gospel of Judas, Jesus takes Judas Iscariot aside and gives him all of the insight into what true knowledge is all about. He tells him about life in the world. He tells him that he is going to suffer, that he's going to go through a great deal of grief in his own life, to be sure. But he explains to Judas what the world is really all about, that in the beginning there is a high God that is so infinite that there is no word, there is no description that can describe what the divine is all about. And from that light and life of God, Jesus says to Judas in the Gospel of Judas, there is an evolution or a devolution of light that finally comes down into a world of mortality down below. And then there is an angel, an angelic kind of figure, who is the creator of this world, who puts that light, packs that light into bodies, into our human bodies, and makes human beings that have a bit of the light of God within, but have mortal flesh on the outside. And that's what we are now. We're mortal beings who have a bit of God inside of us, a bit of that light inside of us, and need to come to knowledge in order to find truth and to find joy in this world and beyond this world. And so this is what Jesus has to say to Judas Iscariot. It's the message of salvation that he delivers to Judas Iscariot.
Mm-hmm.
What a remarkable kind of place that Judas seems to have.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jesus says to Judas, and you know, you're going to sacrifice the man who bears me, the person, the flesh that I'm wearing, because Jesus makes it clear that the real Jesus is not the mortal flesh that can die, that can be crucified, but the real Jesus is the light within, just mm-hmm. as the real human being, for any human being, mm-hmm. is the enlightened person that is within. And so Jesus explains to Judas that in fact, he will turn Jesus over to the authorities. He will sacrifice this body. But by the time he sacrifices or turns the body over in the so-called betrayal, Jesus, the spiritual Jesus, will be gone. The Jesus of light will be going back up to heaven. And in fact, Judas, leading the way with the other disciples, has a kind of a vision of Jesus in a light cloud, thus understanding exactly what it means for Jesus to be an enlightened person, and for every other person, including the disciples themselves and all people of Gnosis, all Gnostics,
mm-hmm.
to be enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
So that here is a text that is a very interesting text, very well written, that means to have a subtle kind of place of Jesus as a being of light who is in this world, and Judas as somebody who betrays Jesus,
mm-hmm.
but not the real Jesus. He hands over the mortal flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that happens, the text comes to an end. The Gospel of Judas doesn't even have an account of the crucifixion.
Oh.
It alludes to the fact that there will be a crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
But the crucifixion doesn't have any saving value. What has saving value in the Gospel of Judas and in the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, is knowledge
mm-hmm.
and wisdom and
mm-hmm.
insight. That's what has saving value, not the death of mortal flesh
mm-hmm.
on a Roman cross. And so that's the kind of message that we have from the Gospel of Judas too. There has been a goodly amount of debate, as you would expect, because Judas Iscariot himself is a very interesting and a very disturbing kind of character throughout so much of the Judeo-Christian Islamic heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in terms of the Gospel of Judas, there are some scholars who point to the fact that, well, aren't there still negative things about Judas? Well, that's the tradition, you know, that he's the one that, in fact, handed Jesus over. But the fact of the matter is, what the Gnostics were able to do, and Irenaeus of Lyon, one of the people who wrote against the Gnostics, says that about the Gospel of Judas and about Judas Iscariot. What the Gnostics can do is they can sometimes take people who are the rabble-rousers,
mm-hmm.
those that didn't fit in, those who were protesting against religion and the domestication, the everyday quality of religion. Often the Gnostics could take these people that were really repudiated by many religious folks, and could make them into the heroic figures.
Mm-hmm.
People, figures, beings like the serpent from Genesis, who is actually an advocate of knowledge and tells Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge. Isn't that something good? What about Cain? Cain can be made into a good figure. What about Judas Iscariot himself? Can he also be made into a figure who is the recipient of knowledge and the one who passes that knowledge to all the readers of the Gospel of Judas? That's the significance, and that's the place of the Gospel of Judas, and that is the rich kind of acquisition that we have in the mm-hmm. discovery of the Gospel of Judas.
Mm-hmm. Marvin, I understood you to say that Jesus was not the man, but the light within. And yet I hear other people call the light within the Christ consciousness. Are those used synonymously, or what do people mean by the Christ consciousness?
Well, among the Gnostics and within Gnostic texts in particular, the idea that is communicated really is that Jesus and other humans, other people, have most everything in common.
Mm-hmm.
That is, Jesus takes upon himself mortal flesh and lives in the flesh for a period of time, even as other men and women do that.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus comes down to live in the world for a period of time, even as all human beings lived in the world for a period of time. Jesus discovers the knowledge within himself and has the divine light within, even as people of Gnosis have the divine light within.
Mm-hmm.
What Jesus can do that is needed is Jesus can provide a wake-up call.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus can provide sayings that can shake us up, that can bring us to an enlightened kind of position. So that could be described as the Christ consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, that same light that is within Christ is within other people. And in fact, there can even be, as we saw with the Gospel of Thomas,
mm-hmm.
there can be an identification of that kind of light, so that Jesus says, I myself shall become that person, you know, that
mm-hmm.
person that,
mm-hmm.
that drinks from my knowledge. In fact, one becomes one in that way, in that kind of mystical way with Christ. That's why I like to think of the Gnostics as being really mystics,
mm-hmm.
having a mystical kind of approach,
mm-hmm.
Looking not just for an ability to know something about God or about Christ, but rather to be joined to God, to realize a oneness with the divine, to find out that there is a bit of the divine that is within,
mm-hmm.
and that makes all the difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. Marvin, what would we learn about Mary from the Gnostic Gospels?
Well, Dan Brown learned a lot about Mary and wrote a book, The Da Vinci Code, and you know, the fact of the matter is, I really am grateful to Dan Brown. I've been on a couple of television programs with him talking about the Gospel of Mary and the Da Vinci Code and so forth. I'm not especially pleased with the book that he wrote in terms of the style of the book and so on,
mm-hmm.
but I'm delighted that, in fact, he called attention to the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Philip and what many of these texts have to say about Mary Magdalene. Because when we go back to the New Testament, the fact is there are these people that are called students or disciples. And the New Testament Gospels, that is, the Gospels that were selected for inclusion in the New Testament, seem to know that there were 12 disciples.
Mm-hmm.
They were all guys. They were all young men, according to the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the New Testament Gospels are not clear about their names, and there are variations in the names that are given in the list of the 12. But they know that they're all men and that there are 12 of them. The Gnostic texts, with their references to Mary Magdalene and others, make it much clearer that that idea that there are only 12 guys who are the disciples is an imposition upon the historical Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, this is an idea, a very nice idea, that comes out of the early church. It does not reflect what actually went on in the Jesus movement. In fact, Jesus did have some students or some young men and women around him, and it becomes clear now that there were men and women, and the exact number is quite unclear. But one of the things that the Gospel of Mary makes clear, along with the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Thomas and some other texts, is the fact that one person that seems to have been very close to Jesus was Mary of Magdala, this woman Mary, who sometimes is described as a beloved disciple. Maybe she's the beloved disciple or one of the beloved disciples.
Mm-hmm.
But she seems to have been, frankly, something of a soulmate, is described as being something of a soulmate, somebody who understood what Jesus was about, understood his mind, shared his vision. And that's what becomes clear in the Gospel of Mary. Unfortunately, there have been some impious worms that have eaten away at the papyrus of the Gospel of Mary, so we're missing some pages at the beginning, we're missing some pages in the middle of the text, and not that much remains. There are a couple of little fragments that remain that come from Oxyrhynchus, from that rubbish heap from antiquity. And so we do have a few Greek words that have remained from antiquity as well. But what we have of the Gospel of Mary makes it clear that she was the one, according to that text, who had a special kind of understanding of who Jesus was, that she's the one that helps the others. Peter himself says, along with other disciples, look, we know that Jesus, you know, cared more about you than the rest of us, and he told you some things that we didn't hear about. Can you help us out? Can you communicate some of the kind of wisdom that Jesus had? And she does that. And so this becomes, I think, a remarkable occasion to reflect upon the early church and the early Jesus movement, and to see that there were women as well as men who played important roles and had significant positions and communicated important ideas in the early church. And it also becomes a remarkable kind of moment to think about the fact that there must have been not only young men, but also young women who were a part of the group of people that, with Jesus, were trying to find out where God can be located in this world and what the reign and presence and power of God is all about. And if Mary then is a part of that, along with some of the others, men and women that we hear about, then we begin to get some idea, I think, of the dynamic quality of what Jesus was about, too, when he calls upon those around to look for a different order of family, of brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and so on. This new kind of family includes people like Mary Magdalene and Peter and Andrew and James and John, maybe Salome as well. That is, all these people that with Jesus are looking for God. So that finally, at the end of the day, the Gospel of Mary becomes a much more exciting text than even the Da Vinci Code. I mean, here is, as they say, the real thing. And here is a text that really helps us understand something that is rather new and fresh about the circle of disciples and the Jesus movement in the early days.
Marvin, why do you think that these important Gospels were omitted from the traditional Christian Bible?
The whole story of how certain texts of the dozens of Gospels and all the Acts of the Apostles and all the letters and all of the apocalypses and revelations and so on, how certain of those texts were chosen and some were excluded, that's rather a complicated story. The whole issue of the canon and the canonizing process is a rather complicated business. And one person who, frankly, plays very rightly an important role in the history of anti-Semitism, Marcion of Pontus, who was looking for a new Bible, not a Jewish Bible, not anything like the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures, but a Christian Bible, you know, he plays a role in picking out Paul and Pauline-type text as being the text that should be Christian text. Certainly that is the case. Irenaeus of Lyon wanted there to be four Gospels, and that may be where the idea of four Gospels comes from. But finally, it was the set of emerging Orthodox theological perspectives in the early church. It is the political position and the theological position of the people that had the loudest voices and finally were carrying the day in the early church. It was that set of voices, it was that set of influences that decided upon what books are going to be authoritative and what books are not going to be authoritative, what books are going to be included in a Bible or a canon, and what books are going to be excluded. And by the time that these decisions were being made, the majority of the voices that were being heard at church councils and in individual churches and throughout the Mediterranean basin, the majority of those voices were advocates of a gospel of the cross, an approach to Jesus through the crucifixion and the resurrection, an emphasis upon Paul, but Paul, as he's kind of watered down a little bit by the pastoral epistles, with the final edition, as it turned out, of one token apocalypse to kind of give a vision of the future. This is reflective of emerging orthodoxy. And so the winners in the debate about orthodoxy and heresy are the ones who put together the sacred scriptures. that meant that some texts were going to be left out, texts that were more mystical, texts that had a different vision of Jesus as really a Jewish teacher of wisdom who provides life in his words and so forth. Those texts were the texts that were not included, as a matter of fact. And we would not even have known about those, because texts that are not thought to be authoritative and shouldn't be read by the faithful often are burned or thrown into rivers, or at least are not recopied.
Mm-hmm.
And had it not been for the sands of Egypt and for the fact that a certain number of these texts were buried away in those dry sands, only to be discovered in the modern period, we still would not know about them. But now, at last, in the last 100 years or so, we're finding out more and more about these texts. And it really is changing the way that we look at the early church and developments in the early church, and it's changing the way that we look at Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Were these a threat to the early churches?
Well, you know, if you read through Irenaeus of Lyon, he's called a heresiologist. That is a writer against, really, an inventor of the category of heresy. That is, of what the others are thinking, those who are not a part of our group, but those who have different ideas. If you read through some of this literature of Irenaeus and some of the other heresiologists, Clement of Alexandria, Hippolytus of Rome, Epiphanius of Salamis, if you read through some of these accounts, they are full of anger, they are full of hostility, they're full of words of damnation, because these folks really felt that there was a threat here.
Mm-hmm.
There was a different way of looking at Jesus, there was a different set of priorities, there was a different lifestyle that was being advocated by these people that claimed to be followers of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of in-house argument was often a very heated kind of argument. In fact, even the Gospel of Judas, by the way, comes back at some of the heresiologists and has its own, you know, anger and animosity regarding some of the leaders of the church.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there was perceived to be a great difference among various texts, and there was considerable animosity and a great deal of fear.
Mm-hmm.
In the minds and in the pens, the quills of certain people who are denouncing these kinds of texts. You know, the Gospel of Judas is one of those particular texts that is actually mentioned by name. It was thought to be so dangerous. I mean, Judas betrayed our Lord, it was thought.
Mm-hmm.
And here is a gospel that is written in his name and written with him as a kind of human hero in the
mm-hmm.
gospel.
Mm-hmm.
That was thought to be so dangerous that you have to mention that by name.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to warn the faithful. That's what Irenaeus does. He's the one in the latter part of the second century that talks about the Gospel of Judas. It turns out his description is very, very close to what we find
mm-hmm.
in the newly discovered Gospel of Judas.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these texts were actually mentioned by name. There was another person, an archbishop, Athanasius of Alexandria in Egypt, who at the end, toward the middle and latter part of the 4th century of the Common Era, was very concerned about these things and had an Easter letter that was read in churches and monasteries in Egypt, telling people what they should be reading, what they shouldn't be reading. And he mentions the books. Turns out that he is about the first person that we know of who actually mentions the entire table of contents of the New Testament
mm-hmm.
as being the Christian text that should be written, and not, he says, those heretical texts. It may have been that very letter that caused some monks, some Christian monks in Egypt, to take the texts in what we now call the Nag Hammadi Library and to put those into a jar and bury those away
mm-hmm.
in response to this kind of letter.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of debate that is going on in the early church.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the strong feelings that, in fact, were held by the parties in the debate. And finally, what we now call orthodoxy carry the day. Finally, those creeds were written. Finally, that canon was established. And now we have the chance, really the rich kind of opportunity, to take a new look at that whole process.
Mm-hmm.
Now to have those texts back again and to read those texts and, in a way, make up our own minds, reconsider Jesus, reconsider
mm-hmm.
the early church, and reconsider what it means to be a follower of Jesus and what it means to look for wholeness and healing and salvation in this world.
Mm-hmm. Are these gospels accepted by all Christian groups now?
You mean the Gnostic Gospels?
Right, right.
They by no means are accepted by most Christian groups. In fact, the position of the mainstream church remains the same as before. There is a Bible that is accepted as canon, and these other texts are apocryphal. Mm-hmm. That is to say, they are not to be taken as authoritative. They are not to be read in a serious kind of way. In fact, when the Gospel of Judas came out, there were church leaders that denounced the Gospel of Judas again, even before they read it.
Mm-hmm.
There was one comment, the Gospel of Judas was heretical when it was written in the second century. It's heretical to the present day. Let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
I went around speaking about the Gospel of Judas. I've spoken about the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary as well. But in particular, I did some lecture tours speaking about the Gospel of Judas because there was so much interest in mm-hmm. this particular text when mm-hmm. it came out. People wanted to know. They wanted to find out, what is this Gospel of Judas Iscariot? Anyway, so I went around as an historian to explain what was going on. And not only were there people who were very curious and very interested, there also were people that were eager to denounce it. In fact, there was even a letter-writing campaign that was directed against those of us who were the editors and the translators mm-hmm. of the Gospel of Judas,
mm-hmm.
Coming from faithful Christians, it was said, who told us that unless we retracted this gospel and recalled copies of the book that had been sold and so forth, we would be experiencing the punishments of hell very soon, and we better buy our asbestos boots. I received literally hundreds of letters like that. So that to the present day, I would say there is an interest among people that are open to new possibilities. There's a real interest in talking about these texts, but there are church leaders who still to the present day maintain the same kind of position regarding orthodoxy and heresy.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like I've heard that people that are religious tend to have all the answers, whereas those of us who are spiritual are searching for the answers.
That's a very interesting comment, and I certainly consider myself to be a searcher as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I suppose that the problem is, in a church that is a confessional kind of church, that has creeds and has statements, has theological positions,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to be adhering to the party line, do you have to go back and agree with all those positions? I mean, can you have an open mind when it comes to new information? I would like to think that this is a time when we can be excited about the new information and be willing and, in fact, eager to go back
right.
and take a fresh kind of look.
Right.
There really has never been a time quite like this before. Now we have at our disposal methods of reading texts and of doing archaeological research that can give us new insights into the world of antiquity. Now we have methods that are not governed by the church, not governed by the theology of the church. We can be independent historians and linguists to read through these kinds of texts. What an exciting time
right.
to take a look at these texts
mm-hmm.
and decide for ourselves.
Right.
And I guess that invitation is one that I try to give to my students and I would give to anybody who is listening today. Take a look at these texts. Decide for yourself. They can only enlighten you in terms of historical and literary remains of antiquity, and they might provide you with some interesting insights into the ways that people have lived and still live, and the ways that people have believed and still believe in
mm-hmm.
the world.
Mm-hmm. Then, Marvin, do you have closing thoughts before we look at your books and services and how people can reach you?
Well, I suppose that I would simply want to say that I consider myself to have been extraordinarily fortunate to have had the chance to take a look at some of these texts. To be on the inside of the work on the Gospel of Judas was a profound kind of pleasure. To live at a time where we can look at these kinds of materials and not worry about being tied to a stake and burned and so forth, but being open to a religious kind of quest, an historical kind of quest, to be open to looking at the beliefs and the ideas of a variety of people. All of this is a very enriching sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that for me, it has given me a much deeper sense, not only of a tolerance of diversity,
mm-hmm.
but a celebration of diversity. Religions in general are very diverse from one another. And we are all the richer as human beings because of the diversity of religion.
Right.
It turns out that Christianity has always been a very diverse phenomenon. Now we know from these texts that in the beginning there was diversity, probably going back to the historical Jesus and the men and women around him who had different points of view. There has always been diversity. And even though we at times have dealt with that in a rather poor kind of way, imposing our will upon other people, we may be in a position now, and I hope and pray that may be the case, where we can also celebrate that diversity and understand the significance and the power of that diversity. There are various ways to believe. There are various ways to see value. There are various ways to be spiritual. And if we can look to each other and enjoy that in each other, we will all be the better as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if there's anything that the world needs right now, with really a lack of tolerance that is seen in various communities,
right,
we need to have that kind of tolerance and more than that, that kind of acceptance and that kind of celebration
mm-hmm.
of the commonalities that we share, but also the differences that can enrich who we are as human beings.
Right. Mm-hmm. Marvin, would you tell us about your books and how the listeners can locate these and how they could reach you if you have a website?
I do have a website. It's more or less geared into the Gospel of Judas, but that website is www.chapman.edu/Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R. And anybody is welcome to come to that website. My email address is Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R, @chapman.edu. And I'd be very happy to receive notes from people and to discuss various things with people, because that's what we are about mm-hmm. these days with these texts, trying to find our way into a greater understanding of and appreciation of where we have come from and where we might be going.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned books. And anybody can go to Amazon and take a look at some of the books that I've done. There are quite a few books I think that might be of interest. I'll just mention a couple. A very recent book that I did with Shambhala, with a very dear friend of mine, Willis Barnstone, who is just a marvelous poet, and he and I have collaborated on some books together. We really use opposite sides of the brain. I come with a knowledge of Greek and Coptic and so on, and with a knowledge of the history of the Gnostics and Gnostic texts, and he comes with some of that as well, but with a real poetic sense. And so we have done some translations together to render into good English,
mm-hmm.
into English that really sings as prose and poetry, some of these texts. And a book that just came out by Willis and myself is Essential Gnostic Scriptures, with the subtitle, or the descriptive line, I love this
mm-hmm.
line,
mm-hmm.
Texts of luminous wisdom from the ancient and medieval worlds, including the Gospels of Thomas, Judas, and Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
One of the nice things about this edition, by the way, of the Gospel of Judas is the fact that not only is it a very nice poetic translation, and I think that any listener would enjoy reading this particular translation. It really is a joy to have done, and a joy to read, and a joy to hear being mm-hmm. read aloud, as mm-hmm. a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we were able to get into the translation, a whole collection of fragments, which is another story for another time.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a number of holes, a substantial number of holes in the papyrus text. And the papyrus was missing from those holes, could not be found. And lo and behold, those fragments were discovered in a collection. They have been photographed and translated by myself along with some colleagues, and we've been able to get all those fragments in. So now most of the Gospel of Judas,
mm-hmm.
in fact, is to be found in this edition published
mm-hmm.
by Shambhala just a few
mm-hmm.
weeks ago.
Right.
If you want to have more gnosis than you can imagine, try the Gnostic Bible. Willis Barnstone and I both edited that, and there are texts also that come out of the world of Islam. The Umm al-Kitab, the mother of books, as it is called, is given here. It's a beautiful text that comes out of Shiite Islam, as well as traditional texts of Gnosis, Manichaean texts, Mandean texts, Cathar literature, and so on. It's a very thick and remarkable book. And then the standard kind of edition of the Nag Hammadi Library is the Nag Hammadi Scriptures, published by Harper.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the International Edition. I'm the editor and did much of the translating, but various folks from all around the world have been incorporated into the project. It really is just a wonderful book to read. So these are some of the kinds of books that are out there. I'm happy to say that there is increasingly a very substantial literature because there are so many people that find this to be rather engaging. It's new material.
Right.
New material that can give a new set of insights, you know, for a new day. And from that point of view, as an historian and as a student of literature, I find this to be just quite remarkable and certainly very exciting.
Well, I thank you very much, Marvin. This has been very interesting to me, and I know it will be to the listeners.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I wish you and I wish all of the hearers all the best.
Thank you.
I waited over a year and turned down several offers for sponsors to find the right one. After reviewing the current issue of a distinctive style magazine, I know that with God's help, I picked the right one. The video interviews, the written pages, the magnificent pictures, and the music I heard were all fantastic and included interviews with such stars as Clarice Leachman, Mark Victor Hansen, and Antonio Sabato, Jr., and music by Paula Nelson, daughter of Willie Nelson, and Mark Ballas in his debut solo album. But this was just the start. Then there was a series on cancer in celebration of National Cancer Month, and interviews included survivors and those who work with cancer, such as Olivia Newton-John, a survivor, Melinda Marchiana, a 16-year-old survivor, Fran Drescher, and Dr. Sharon Winter, also a survivor who used alternative treatments and later became a naturopathic physician to help others. Then I saw a picture of a magnificent cathedral, probably in Europe, and heard the voice of 7-year-old Rima Marvana singing Amazing Grace and the Lord's Prayer. Reading about her compassion for others and hearing her voice brought tears to my eyes. Magazines do not come better than the Distinctive Style magazine. I can't imagine what could top this issue, but I look forward to seeing, and I'm sure you will want to also. Go to www.adistinctivestyle.com to subscribe to this remarkable magazine.